This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Corey Wright.
And I'm Adam Scalina. Good to be back,
Corey. Yeah, you made a good comment there. Since we last saw each other, the world's completely changed.
Yeah.
It's completely changed. Like literally, Trump's back in power now.
David Eby's back in power.
For a third time. Like it's just, I don't even know.
There's a Tyson fight tonight.
Tyson's fighting a YouTuber tonight. Yeah. Like, and did you see the weigh-ins? How old would Tyson be now? He's got to be what, 60s?
Oh, he's got to be.
The guy was shredded.
Yeah.
I saw the news highlights because he slapped the other guy.
He slapped Jake Paul.
Jake Paul. Yeah. And he was ripped.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. I think I know he's old, but in his prime, I don't think there was anything scarier on earth.
Yeah.
I would rather run into a T-Rex than Mike Tyson in his prime in a back alley. Like he's the type of guy, if he hit you in the face, he was going to kill you. He was just that powerful.
I'm always, you know, I'm watching tonight, but I'm always let down by these events, these like big kind of promotional events, right? It's like something's going to happen. It will be like, and I didn't even read this, but I just saw an article on the way in there where the rules are like, everyone's kind of pissed off because the rules are really restrictive.
Oh, it's so not just course, a boxing match?
No, it's probably going to be. I mean, it's just going to be a spectacle and then it's going to end in this kind of, you know, whatever, quick fashion. And you're going to feel like, you know. It's free. It's free on Netflix.
It's free. Well, I thought it was just a boxing match. These guys are just going to slug it out and Tyson's going to kill this kid.
Yeah. Actually, apparently,
though. Is the kid wearing one of those foam helmets?
He's actually apparently a pretty good boxer. But I mean, yeah, Tyson. But anyways. It'll be interesting. The world has changed, but we're burying the lead here. Derek Fluker, Senior Vice President of Acquisitions and Asset Management at West Group, is on the program today.
Yeah, great
I'm
episode.
So excited about this. We obviously are big fans of West Group and what they're doing in Metro Vancouver. On Sister Show Vancouver Real Estate Podcast, we've had Bo Jarvis on the show a few times.
Yep.
We've had guests on Commercial Real Estate.
We've had Brad on from West Group. Yeah. Yeah, came on and joined us all about that. We talked about ACCs and DCCs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And Derek's coming on today. I think this topic's phenomenal. Speaking about a boxing match.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, this is a great topic. It's reality now. It's reality.
Who are the opponents here? Is it West Group versus Metro Vancouver?
It sounds like it. You know, I mean, on the show today, we're going to be talking about, like, this is one thing I think people don't really get. So developers, they buy this land.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe it's a shopping center. Maybe it's a vacant lot. Maybe it's a house assembly. And then at some point in time, the plan is to actually develop that.
Yeah.
But that can be a 2, 3, 4, 5 plus year project sometimes. And in that time frame, a lot can change. And one of the things we're covering today is how the capital gains inclusion rates have changed.
Yeah.
And we're talking today about how potentially an acquisition of maybe, say, a shopping mall as an example might be better suited as a shopping mall than developing it for housing because of all the costs and taxes that are now associated with it for the developers.
So this is, okay, so the impact of capital gains, the capital gains tax and the Metro Vancouver fee increases on creating housing.
Yeah.
And then also this shift from highest and best use versus highest value.
Exactly. And you might find that if I, let's say, hypothetically, I buy a shopping center, I got my Save-On Foods in there, my plan is to build it out into a tower, maybe redevelop the site or multiple towers, and then my costs go up, my taxes go up, I get hit with so many different fee structures now that maybe it's better from a value standpoint to not develop the property, but keep it as a shopping center.
Yeah.
And because of that, that potentially maybe 300, 400, 500, 600 homes that aren't getting built, not because the developer probably doesn't want to build them. It's probably because the cost structure is so much more restrictive than it ever has been before, that it's kind of like, this is better as an income property for us as a shopping center than developing it as a merchant to sell.
Right. So, and I love this. So we talk not only about this issue, but Derek has some case studies that he's actually going to refer to today. Yeah. We talk about a specific multi-tower development site versus the potential of holding a grocery anchored shopping mall.
Yeah.
And we talk about, obviously, how this is going to impact the region. So really excited about this conversation with Derek. Corey, without further ado, why don't we cut to this conversation? Derek Fluker, West Group.
Enjoy, guys. This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial. John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
Okay, so we're here with Derek Fluker. He is the Senior Vice President of Acquisitions and Asset Management at West Group. How you doing, Derek?
Good. Nice. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time today. Derek, we've had a few folks from West Group on in the past, so really excited to have you on the program. We're big fans of West Group. But can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I've been in the industry 20 years now, which I hadn't really fully put together until for this podcast. I started at Colliers. I was there for just under five years. And then I started with partners of brokerage, very focused on retail, and we kind of grew past that over the years. Did that for 10 years and sold that company to Marcus & Millichap and worked with them for about a year and joined West Group in 2020. So that's kind of my 20-year history.
Nice. Maybe thinking about that transition from being at Colliers to doing your own thing and then joining a development company, why did you transition into joining West Group?
It was, I'd been in brokerage at that point for 15 years, call it. And I would say I was probably starting to feel a little bit repetitive and I wasn't learning as much as I was in the early days and was keen to, I guess, understand more past the deal closing and then get more into the development side. I had worked with West Group for over 10 years at that point. So it was a really strong relationship where I knew their values. I knew the people. I understand how they operated and how they interacted with the other side on a deal. So I had immense respect for them already. So it was an easy decision when we started having the conversation.
And you started with West Group right in 2020?
It was fall 2020. So we were definitely in
deep COVID. The pandemic.
when I first started coming in, there was about five of us that were in the office at that point. And just Teams meetings and getting to know people at a new company when it's all virtual. But it's still COVID wasn't exactly fun, but as far as moving into a new company at that point, it went pretty smooth.
Right.
It was easy because of the existing relationship, I'd say.
Yeah, makes sense for sure. What is as Senior VP of Acquisitions and Asset Management, what does your day-to-day look like?
Oh, that's a good question. It's quite varied. So my role is overseeing the existing portfolio. So we have industrial, residential, retail, office, rent, kind of in all the asset classes. So there's the oversight and working on the existing portfolio. There's a high level of collaboration with the development team. Because our primary objective is to build for the portfolio. So there's a lot of discussion of what should we build, what works for this market. A lot of it's working within different municipal policies. So you're kind of mixed use is just a series of trade-offs, and you're trying to balance that between the commercial, there might be a rental component and a condo component. So there's a lot of balancing in that. So that's on the asset management side of it. Acquisitions, I think you guys have a pretty good idea of what people on the acquisition side are doing. So that can be working with, well, it's obviously just evaluating the market, talking with potential partners, and so on.
Well, Derek, we appreciate you taking the time to join us today. And as we talked about before we recorded here, you guys had put together a study, which I think is phenomenal, because I think a lot of our listeners, you know, necessarily they may understand like highest and best use of a property, because you hear that a lot of times, especially when it comes to property tax time and the assessment values and single or two-story buildings getting assessed for higher and better uses. But now you guys have kind of unpacked sometimes what is maybe the highest and best use may not be the greatest valuable use. And a lot of that can be derived by fees and costs and taxes and stuff like that. We wanted to have you on the program to kind of discuss more about that type of thing, because obviously that's impacting dramatically developers' decision, and more importantly, houses maybe that aren't getting built because of stuff that now goes into that. And I know you provided us with a great case study here that we'll dive into, but can you maybe tell us a little bit about before that, what kind of drove this case study? What are you guys seeing that sort of made the sense like, hey, maybe this site isn't worth developing now because of now these new cost structures that we have to consider?
This probably started about 2 years ago when we had, so a lot of our income properties are kind of potential development sites. And we were going through entitlements and looking at the pro forma and the land residual in that pro forma. And as we were going through it, we were looking at it going, well, it's actually worth more to just keep it. And in some cases, the rents were below market because it had a demo clause. Maybe it had deferred maintenance and because we were kind of getting it ready for redevelopment. And increasingly, we're sitting in these meetings looking at pro forma, and we converted an industrial building back to just IPP. We did a 10-year lease on it. We're looking at residential buildings where we're like, you know, we could just maintain this as is and not go through the risk and brain damage of development. So there was probably two or three where we made that decision, and it was, you know, very isolated. From there, it was a kind of a theory, is like, how broad is it? Are these isolated, or is this like across the board? So the team kind of started diving into it and looking at the difference in values and kind of what's transpired here. And really, it comes down to when you convert an existing asset to development, you incur capital gains. There was an increase in capital gains. So that's reducing your net proceeds as an owner, regardless of it, all else being equal, what you end up with at the end of the day is that much less. And then the bigger factor, not beyond capital gains, was the various municipal and Metro Vancouver fees and what that was doing to the value. So from a condo buyer or a tenant's perspective, the price or the rent may be the same, but the value, the residual value of that land was significantly lower. And so it's just pushing people in the direction of retaining their assets.
So Derek, most people listening to this show will know the capital gains inclusion rate jumped from 50% to, I think, a 66.67%. What about the stepped Metro Vancouver regional development cost charges? How has that changed? Or can you unpack that a little bit for our listeners?
We could spend a couple hours on this.
Maybe just broad strokes. Have they increased recently, or like, can you maybe like, what has maybe changed there?
So between 2015 to 2027, they will have gone up from just over $1,000 to $21,000.
Wow.
And that's just Metro Vancouver. Each municipality has similar increases, maybe not to the same extent because Metro fees were only $1,000 at that point, and they've obviously grown exponentially. But an example, just in the city of Vancouver, going back to 2015, it would be $13,000 for a unit.
Wow.
And it's going to be, well, in 2027, it'll be $54,000 per unit. So that's just one unit. The average unit is just over 600 square feet, maybe 650. So that's a lot for that unit to, you just can't carry it. And then you've also have all the other reasons, all the other pressures you have on development.
And these are typically, I think what a lot of people generally don't understand is these costs are passed on to the consumer. Is that right?
Yes, but not in a direct way. And I think that's where the politicians, frequently you'll hear, as a developer, you will charge the most you possibly can. And that's reasonable. If the market will accept that price, that's what a developer will charge. The reason, the indirect way that it does get passed through is that significantly fewer sites are viable for development. So less is being delivered. So there's less product available, which drives the price up. So yes, it does get passed through, but not in that direct, like it's not a direct line on the statement of adjustments.
Right. So it's essentially if the market will bear it, then we see housing built. And if it won't, then often we see a pivot to something that's, because at the end of the day, the whole goal for a development company is to turn a profit.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Right now it's not a profitable business the way it once was.
Right. Right. And so I just want to and this is kind of deviating a little bit away from the study, but for people listening that don't understand, like why is there so much of a friction? Like clearly we're trying to get more housing in the region, but it seems like a lot of the municipal policies or the regional policies are at odds with what we're really attempting to do, or what it seems like at least politically the motivation is.
I think the majority of policy is well-intended, but not coordinated with various other policy changes that are happening. We put together a list of all of the different potential policy changes or consultations we're going through, and it was just shy of 300. So there's all kinds of moving parts right now. And individually, each one is well-intended, but the cumulative effect is just grinding development to, I don't want to say halt, that's probably overly dramatic, but it's making it impossible to move things forward. To your point, I guess, going back to your original question on those fees, they're balanced in their own budgets. I think there's probably, we've become overly reliant on development fees to fund the municipal budgets and shifted away from the property tax base or just traditional property taxes. And at the end of the day, you probably also have to look at can we just reduce spending? Because there's just too much the budgets have grown exponentially over the years. So the money has to come from somewhere is a common comment. Maybe the money could come out of a budget, cutting back on spending, which hasn't happened at all.
So Derek, one thing that I'm really curious about here is some of our listeners may not understand about the capital gains that have to be when you're going through the entitlement and switching the assets and stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit about what that process is for our listeners that probably wouldn't be too aware? They would assume a developer, you buy land, you build a building, you sell me houses at overpriced, I buy, we move on. But can you sort of tell me about that process when I got a commercial asset, I'm going to entitle that land, get it into a development site, and capital gains exposures that for the developers that they have to consider in their performance?
I could explain a very specific example.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Your grocery anchored shopping center that has been around for 30 years. It's well performing. And maybe, it has your pharmacy, a Starbucks, a bank, and a grocery store. And a family's owned that for 30 years. And they collect rent, they took a mortgage out, they've refinanced over the years, but they have a very low cost base. Let's say they've owned that for 30 some odd years. Rents have grown and they have the option of just doing nothing. They can just continue to collect rent. You guys might call them and say, hey, your site is beside a SkyTrain station. We can sell it to a developer.
Yep.
And what they'll do is they will probably call their accountant and say, what is my capital gains exposure? And when they give you a price that they're willing to sell for, they're less worried about the top line price. They're yep. more worried about the bottom line yep. of what they're going to receive, because they're most likely going to reinvest that money into something else. So they'll only sell if they're receiving more. Like if they can grow their income or they can kind of recycle that capital and get a better asset or whatever the case may be. And with capital gains going up, the price that they need to end up with that same, call it net price, is higher. Does that kind of summarize the vendor's perspective?
And I'm
sure you
absolutely.
Guys have these conversations. Like I was a broker for a long time and capital gains was an issue. It was always a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I didn't know any better based on your comments there, I would say you've been through this situation various times in your past. Meeting with landowners, yeah, trying to convince them, yeah, to sell. And then they call you back later and they say, oh, I hate the government. They're taking all my money. I don't want to sell, but I will sell for this now. And the buyer's going to pay for that capital gains now.
Yeah. So, and it's not necessarily that the buyer has to pay for it. Base that vendor is willing to sell for is now higher.
Exactly. So
higher likelihood that it just stays as is.
Yep.
And it's just kind of an underutilized asset. So on the flip side of that, in a rising market and lower capital gains, I think developers were unlocking sites and things were moving forward. They call it the market was largely working.
Yep.
So capital gains is you're pushing the vendor to wait out for a higher price. So they may need 10 or 15% more as their from a price expectations to convince them to sell.
Yep.
On the flip side, as a developer, we don't value land based on comps or the cap rate necessarily. We're working towards a residual to ensure we have a profitable development.
Yeah, for sure.
We're kind of agnostic to what those expectations are. We just need to we're trying to work towards a viable development. We're going to have a 15% return on cost. And what's happened with the additional fees is we can actually pay less. So rather than being able to meet in the middle with that vendor, you guys get to do, you get a deal done and, the transaction moves forward. We are offering that vendor less than what they need. So theoretically, let's pretend that there's that equilibrium where we were meeting in the middle. We might now be willing to pay 15% less than we could previously pay because of the money that's going towards fees.
Yep.
And that's just locking up all kinds of sites. And we're seeing it with properties that kind of come to us and you guys know the drill. You propose a site and we're like, the math doesn't work or it doesn't pencil. It's not, we can't pay that price. And that's really that kind of prompted us to do a deeper dive on it. And it's part of the provincial it's within the legislation for the, I believe it's called the Municipal Land Act, where the fees are supposed to be at a level that does not discourage development. And we've got past that point. And that's why I think you're seeing sites that arguably should be redeveloped, renovated, tenants are just being renewed long-term and not moving forward. Or trading at an income value, because the income value in many cases is now higher than the development value.
Yep. Yep. No, I think you did a great job explaining that. Sometimes the public may not understand that if the going rate for a sellable price per foot of what you're actually selling the condo into the marketplace for is X, and you go through your financing and your hard costs and your soft costs and all of these things that take to get the land from A to B, when you can only sell it for so much at the time you're putting your pro forma, there's only one thing that can give at the end of the day. And as fees go up or financing costs goes up or hard costs or soft costs go up, the only thing in that equation that can give is the acquisition price. And that goes back to that vendor having to try to sell their land for less because there's so many things that are lumped in and you kind of, for some degree, kind of have a ceiling you got to work under because the public's only going to pay so much for that product at that time that you don't want to be paying for your own risk buying into the future and trying to have a 25 or 30% lift on that sellable price to see if it comes to fruition, that it all comes back to the landowner now that they have to give to make it work, which if they're not going to give, it just equates into less housing because of all the costs now that these developers have to incur.
100%. Land is the shock absorber within a development pro forma. It's the only thing that you can manage. But as a vendor, and you often hear like the greedy landowners or they're asking too much. They have other options. They own it. It's their investment. And they're going to choose what provides the best return to them, their family, their company, whatever the case may be. But that's, that shouldn't be viewed negatively. That's their, if it's a company, that's their responsibility. If it's their family, they're trying to do what's best in terms of maximizing value. And I think that's where the policy needs to be looked at to ensure that sites that are close to transit that would make for good housing are still more valuable on a development basis than they are on an existing, call it IPP, long-term hold.
Well, I think if you look at too, even when we talked about strata windups, and that was like a big thing where obviously there's so many strata windups for old wood frame walk-up buildings along the SkyTrain lines that at one point there was a premium for a development site because of the increased density and all that stuff. And you fast forward now with all the costs that a developer has to incur to get that. A lot of these strata windups are now probably worth more as individual strata lots than they are as a development site. And you're really seeing that tail off because it feels like there's a ceiling on what you can sell for. Your costs have changed dramatically to do it. And these individual condos are worth more as a condo than they are as collective as a site. And we're also seeing that on the income side of it, on the brokerage business, where we're valuing things as a development site or as an income play. And more times than not, because development sites haven't been moving as much because of costs and interest rates and all that stuff that go into it, that it's kind of better as an income play now.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You're seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't surprise me you're seeing the same thing.
Derek, so maybe just to kind of spell out the unintended consequences of this, can we talk a little bit about unintended consequences and outcomes of the case study that you've put together? And then also maybe thoughts on how we might get through this or improve this situation we're in?
So starting with the consequences, we've somewhat touched on it. It won't be obvious, but sites that should be developed will remain as is. If there's income, you'll largely see that just remain as is. From a government point of view, they're missing out on the GST revenue, the TST revenue, the Metrovan DCCs, the TransLink DCCs, the property transfer tax, the capital gains, the municipal DCCs, the municipal TACs. All those numbers, by they've expanded to a point where now they're going to end up getting nothing because it'll just remain. And that'll put, what will happen is until values or like the call it the revenue, condo revenue will eventually, because there's less supply, will rise again. And then we'll get back to a point where we can pay more for those sites. But that's not a good outcome. That means that prices have to go up to unlock that land. If it went the other way and there was just increased supply, we would unlock more land, more sites. There would be just generally more activity. And I actually think the overall tax revenue would be greater. So that's the unintended. What do they do? There's so many things you can do. They need to, I think the easiest thing for the municipalities to do is to collect the fees at the end of a project out of project proceeds, because all of these costs get paid for upfront out of, it's really equity, because it's changing the capital stack in a way where these projects are just, they're more capital intensive because you can't finance all of these fees. So if the Metro Vancouver or municipality just waited until the end, that would have a huge impact in itself. I think the fees should arguably go back to where they were. That needs to be revisited and through financial analysis. I think the high level overarching comment would be any policy should ensure that projects are still profitable and viable to move forward. 95% of all housing is built by the private sector, and it is a for-profit business. There's a huge amount of risk. You can see that with I think there's over 6,600 units that have gone through various stages of the foreclosure process. Some have transacted now, but that's the list that we're. So there's huge risk. There has to be a corresponding profit to reward for that. Federal government needs to look at the capital gains inclusionary rate. It just, the 66% is obviously freezing sites, but it's having a negative impact throughout the economy. The way we pay for infrastructure, I'd argue, is being 100% placed on new development when it should be partially covered by the property tax base, and higher levels of government. The province and the federal government earns a huge amount of tax through the development activity, and that some of that money needs to be going directly back to infrastructure. It just, new development can't carry all of it.
Yeah, it's wild to think of like some of these things when you hear them for the first time, it's mind-boggling, like the upfront fees and the fact that we have some of the lowest I think we have some of the lowest property taxes in the country, if I'm not mistaken. And when you think that it's all, a lot of it is being passed on to development when we're trying to get housing, again, seems kind of shocking. And the example that you actually, that the case study, and you know, I think we should maybe try and get this somewhere for people to look at, but maybe there's a...
Yeah, feel free to share it, or I don't know.
Yeah, maybe we can put a link on our site to it, because honestly, it's when you go through it, it's eye-opening. You know, the example you gave was for the building, a site that basically building, I'm guessing it would be a master plan community or something to that effect, of 1,700 homes built, which, you know, definitely needed. And the total benefit to the community was $166 million roughly, right? Mm-hmm. Versus if it doesn't get built, it's 100% of nothing. So I think people need to know just how dire this really is if we're opting to keep grocery stores and shopping centers over redeveloping.
Yeah, and that example, we just used a grocery or like a shopping center as an example, because if everyone's familiar with them, they shop at them, and you're sitting in the parking lot, you can see a SkyTrain, that probably should be redeveloped. But it's the same principles apply to an older, you know, it can be an older apartment building that is ready for redevelopment. It can be industrial office. It could really be anything. But yeah, we just chose the grocery example because it's so familiar for most.
Makes sense. Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Derek. But we do have this segment called the Six Pack, six lighthearted questions to end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Sure.
The Six Pack is powered by our good friends over at Red Point Law.
Red Point Law, Corey, Tim, Falco, Scott, and the team. These are great people with a wealth of experience when it comes to commercial closings and private lending. And I just want to say, Corey, not to cut you off, they have a perfect 5-star review on Google.
So for all your commercial legal needs, visit them at redpointlaw.ca, with offices in Vancouver and now open in downtown Kelowna.
So question number one, a book recommendation for our listeners.
I was actually asked a similar question recently, and the answer was, I grew up in Winnipeg, hadn't traveled a lot. I read the book On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and it kind of sparked an interest in traveling. Ended up doing a bunch of traveling and getting out of Winnipeg. So recommend that book. I do like Ray Dalio, his principles. My takeaway was from it was really just like kind of assume you're wrong and be very open and comfortable with being wrong and look to others and be open to their ideas. So anyway, kind of opposite ends of the spectrum there, but those would be two books.
That's funny. As someone who's also from Winnipeg, who also read Kerouac young and left pretty young, I can relate.
I'll apologize for both of you guys. I didn't know you guys were from Winnipeg. Well, what's going on with your hockey team there? They're like almost undefeated, and they can't put any bums in the seats. Like, what's going on with the hockey team?
They left in the 90s, yeah. And then I moved away, and I would say So I moved to Vancouver and then started cheering for the Canucks.
Not that much better.
When the Jets came back, I was like, whatever. It's not my Jets team. So I've never, yeah. They didn't win me over.
Well, I think they're 15-1 or something like that. And they still can't sell an arena. Like, what's, and this is in Winnipeg. Like, I've only been to Winnipeg on a stopover in a plane, but at minus 50 degrees and 6 feet of snow, what else is there to do except go to the Winnipeg Jets game?
I don't know. That's a good question. It's a fun little arena as well. I don't know why they can't sell it out. They should, though. They're going to end up losing them again.
All right. Yeah. That would be, oh, God. Can you imagine like Winnipeg Jets 2.0 just left for Kansas City? Like, oh, man. All right, Derek, next question up. You've done something horribly wrong. You found yourself on death row, but you're allowed one more meal before it's all said and done. What meal are you having?
This is an interesting one. A sweet tooth. I get like a Black Forest cake or just something.
Oh, there you go.
I can't say it's something I've thought about.
Favorite band or music recommendation?
I'm really digging, going back to my youth here, I'd say Radiohead. Partially because my kids are a bit older now, and they just make so much fun of me. So I've had to lean in and defend some of this older stuff. I was a big fan of Radiohead.
All right, next question up. So you're in a bar, you've had way too much to drink, the night's almost over, and someone gives you a karaoke mic. What song are you singing?
another situation I hope I don't find myself in. I don't know that I've done karaoke. I don't think you're going to see me in this situation. I definitely have a friend who does sings Journey quite often.
Journey.
But I don't see myself getting up there.
And what are you binge watching or a movie recommendation?
Well, you know, this is maybe an embarrassing one, but I'm binge watching Gossip Girl and The OC with my daughter, two daughters right now. And it's been fun watching that with my girls. And like, there's all kinds of like teaching moments about being a teenager in these ridiculous shows.
That's my wife is currently binge watching that without our girls.
For a second there, I was like, oh, maybe that's kind of your taste. And then when you said it with the girls, like, oh, okay, now it makes sense. Like, you know,
I have a 9-year-old and 13-year-old daughter. So
That's coming all right. For me quick.
Last question up here, Derek. Best piece of business advice you feel you received over the course of your career?
You know, I'll give a shout out to Kurt Kuster at Colliers, who gave me this advice probably in my mid-20s, and I was frustrated with a client. And I would say I probably wasn't fully hearing their issues, and I knew where the deal should go, and there was like a lot of logic in that, but I wasn't hearing their concern. And it was really just to show empathy, and nobody will be ready to come to your way of thinking unless they feel heard. And yeah, so that was good advice. And that was probably
great advice.
Plus years ago.
Great advice.
How can people find out more about what you're up to? And of course, what West Group is up to?
Well, obviously there's our website. We've got all our projects and so on. I'd actually put a shout out. We did a campaign explaining some of the issues in the housing development. It's called Homes Don't Just Happen. And we have a YouTube video, and it's quite approachable and hopefully easy to follow, explaining the challenges of why housing is not getting built. So I encourage people to go there. I'm not very active on LinkedIn, but feel free to connect with me there. And West Group has a great team of people posting content on our corporate LinkedIn and Instagram. I think those are the two. So I'd encourage you to follow us there.
Excellent.
Amazing.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time today, Derek.
I appreciate you guys having me on. It's fun.
Thanks so much, Derek.
Put this together.
Great episode. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye. There you have it, folks. Our interview today with Derek Fluker from West Group. Adam, I thought it was outstanding.
Yeah, he just mentioned it and we before we cut for the day, but homes just don't happen, I think is the
West don't Group. Build themselves.
Yeah, and I think we'll have to add a link to that video on the VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com site, because honestly, I feel like this is the type of thing that I think generally people don't quite understand about housing and about the development community.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think we'd all be better served if people just understood this a little bit more, general public.
Absolutely. And, you know, he actually, you know, I think one thing that Derek brings to the table is he was a broker dealing with both vendors and buyers. So he understands both avenues of that. And then he goes on to the acquisition side where now he's acting on behalf of the buyer side. He brings so much knowledge to the table. And I think he was very humble there. Like he was an outstanding, like really big time commercial agent.
Right.
At Form Retail when they started. And Form Retail was a phenomenal company. They obviously got acquired and they still are a great company. But they punched way above their weight class in the projects and the work they did. So he brings so much of that to the table, but now sits on the West Group side of the acquisition. You probably couldn't find a better person to sit in that chair that's been on the buy side, been on the sell side, been the broker. Now he's working in-house, like so much knowledge. And a lot of people sometimes don't realize how much risk it goes into being a developer. And I like how he described how the land price is really like the shock absorber that either makes it or breaks it, because your financing costs are your financing costs, your hard costs are your hard costs, your soft costs over and above financing are your soft costs. Nothing can really change. And the public's only going to pay so much at that time for a product. So if it costs if I have to sell for $1,500, but the public's only paying $1,000, I can't do the project. The only thing that can give is the land.
Yeah.
And if from a landowner's perspective, if you want to pay me $10 million, but as an income play, my site's worth 13, I want to sell it for 13. Because what you do with it after you pay me, I don't care if you put a circus tent on it.
Sure.
I want the highest and best price for my property. And sometimes that's not a development site. And a lot of that is because there's so many costs in that have to now be incurred to build with a ceiling on the sellables, especially as of late, because interest rates have been so high.
Well, Corey, if somebody wants to sell a development site, how can they get in touch?
They can reach us in our Vancouver office anytime, 604-428-5255. You can send me an email, corey@williamwright.ca, or sign up at our website, williamwright.ca, for the latest and greatest news.
Yeah. Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 for all your residential needs. Anyways, Corey, have a great week, everyone. We will be back next week with another great show. Yeah.
Great episode. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Take care.
Subscribe today.